America, Episode 10, A Means Without End. In the Sign of Jonah, around Moby Dick. Laura Harris and Fernando Zalamea. Thursday, 21st of November, 2019.
Shall we start?
Yeah,
okay. So I will be very short. I will be making just a very brief introduction on a very simple idea which I care a lot. And it's a way of presentation of Laura, who will be talking much better than me about these things. So, first of all, this is done. It's a kind of homage to Moby Dick, to the whale, beautiful whales here, produced by Barry for this occasion. 7 hours of work that makes a lot of. But it's something which is interesting for us also, because one of the beautiful things in Melville's Moby Dick is the care for the detail, the extreme care of his writing, which is wonderful for us. So my brief presentation will introduce some images, which are non-standard images, I would say. These are images which are close to me and which are related to a view of Moby Dick as a metaphor for knowledge. We will be talking about that metaphor for knowledge, but also about how Moby Dick is very much related to our quotidian life, as Laura will explain very well. So we have this simple and fundamental idea that whales, in a sense, are well living in a world which is beyond us, beyond our simplicity of life. So whales are in deep waters, which are impossible for us to understand. But on the other hand, we heard a minute ago one of the beautiful poems of Fred in his new book, in which in one moment he says, "We are whales." So this is this beautiful contradiction, in which in one way the whales are beyond us, and in another way we are whales. Mm-hmm. So this is why I'm trying to explain very briefly, and that's all the thing that I'm going to say, that we are, that whales are beyond us, but at the same time we are whales. How is that possible? That's the simple presentation that I will do. So these are images from works on Moby Dick, which are non-standard and not known, because simply they are constructions of a Colombian artist, which is called Gustavo Zalamea, which is my brother. I don't know why we have been completely obsessed by Moby Dick, he from an artistic point of view and me from a literary point of view, and more than that, a metaphorical and mathematical point of view. So these are images in which you can see the Moby Dick in very different perspectives, in which you have at left the text, and the text is introduced to a sculpture of the whale, and the whale is reflected on a glass, and the glass is reflecting us. So already in this very small piece, you have the whale which is there, but we are already in the whale thanks to the glass, etc. In the other one, you have the whale in the middle of a square in Colombia, which is the central political square of all the fights which have been done in Colombia, in which the whale is kind of swimming in the square in dark waters. So dark waters, or the blackness of the whale, the blackness of the white whale is fundamental. There is also an inversion which is clear and which will be fundamental for us. On one side, the whale is white and kind of clear, but on the other side, what is important is that white whale, in some sense, is beyond our usual eyes and lives in the blackness of the deep sea. And then there is this third diagram of my brother, in which there is this illusory and impossible person who is taking Moby Dick on his side. So these three simple figures already show the basic problem. How the whale at the same time is white and black, how the whale at the same time is beyond us and part of us. Here we have the multiple layers that Moby Dick reflects for me. You have a lot of layers. These are layers of the different diagrams and portraits that have been done on Moby Dick. Those different layers show to us that the difficulty or the complexity of understanding the metaphors is always related to these multiple levels that we saw also in the presentation of the gravitational feeling now with Fred and Wu. It's this kind of complex situation in which you have a lot of ropes which are connected together in very different perspectives and very different ways. And this complexity gives a sense of what should be knowledge. Knowledge should be always incorporating a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different layers, and then some common grounds between them. So there are some two passages that I want to read from a book that I have in part on Melville. Since I cannot read English, I shouldn't speak in English. In fact, it's something which is well beyond my capacities. I should ask some person who knows well the language and could read that. I think that Nathaniel Mackie has offered to read these two passages.
Go maybe just in the light. Thanks, Nate.
The patinas of myth are built through an accumulation of diverse pigments of reality. Just as white can be seen as a coalescence of the other colors. In The Whiteness of the Whale, chapter 42, this coalescing white is a symbol of joy, but in turn, of something profoundly elusive, close to panic, of marvel and repugnance. The quote, most yielding, most meaning symbol of spiritual things, nay, the very veil of the Christian's deity, and should be, as it is, the intensifying agent in things the most appalling to mankind, unquote. White, like all myth, incorporates an enormous range of contraries, contradictions which, at heart, are what safeguard its permanent reinterpretative wealth. Melville's writing accumulates multiple strata of reality, interpretation, and imagination, and conjugates multiple voices in a polyvalent plot of novelistic, documental, theatrical, and epic fragments whose net result is the construction of a great myth of the white whale. The thick patina of myth acquires a notable profundity thanks to a full interrelation of deep theological and philosophical symbols with a complex literary architecture. At the bottom of a hopeless metaphysical darkness, after a constant descent to the infernos, Ahab disbelieves the inverse human capacity to ascend. Close to Novalis's aphorism, quote, in both sides we are plus and minus. The knowledge is a medium to obtain again the non-knowledge, unquote. Ahab embodies a tough and lucid conscience that accepts irremediable limits in all intent to know the absolute. However, the wealth of literature can avail itself of a metaphysical obscurity where the lights of science are but subtle illusions. From the reverse of the page, from the bottom of the abyss, an alternative vision that enriches the plus and minus of reality can be acquired. In the romantic reverse disorientation, the destruction of the quadrant is fundamental for the achievement of a full fusion with the subterranean currents of the world. The myth of Moby Dick offers a pasty and complex patina around the North American endeavor to tincture practical reason with pigments of metaphysics and religion. Poe, Hawthorne, and Melville's darkness not only is not casual, but is determining in the full construction of North American culture, particularly attentive and capable of mediating between lights and shadows.
Thank you very much, Nate, for this reading that I couldn't do. This is a translation in progress by a brilliant Brazilian student, Denev Kosikowski, of one of my books. So I will finish just insisting on these two passages on the multiple strata of reality, which is fundamental, the profundity, the metaphysical obscurity, which is required in order to understand our world. Without that metaphysical obscurity, we will never understand anything. So on the bottom of this last diagram, we have the corazón in Spanish, which is the heart. In the middle, razón, which is reason. And in the top, the corazón, which is the dual of the razón in Spanish, just using the hyphen. This is something that doesn't happen in any other language that I know, just in Spanish. You have the dual of reason is really the heart in the very word. So in the corazón, you have the differentials of obscurity, of the deep bottom of the sea, the well which escapes us. And on the other hand, if you do the inverse of the corazón just with the hyphen, then you get something more abstract, which we may call an abstract blackness, and the wideness, differential wideness below. With the inversion, you get the abstract blackness. And that in that abstraction, you can understand that, in fact, in the bottom part, the whale is beyond us. But in the upper part, when you do the inversion, just doing the inversion between razón and corazón, then you get something which is projected onto us. That's where Fred's poem combines the dialectic. Projecting from the top, we are, in fact, whales. But below, there is a whale which is beyond us. So at the same time, the whale, these wonderful whales here, are a metaphor of our understanding of the world and our non-understanding of the world. Both of them are fundamental, and that contradiction is clear. I finish here. I just make a reference that I couldn't bring here with the images because my iPad wouldn't work here with the projection. But I found in the work of the Glasgow boys, a beautiful picture by Arthur Melville. So there is a beautiful connection there, in which Melville produces a wonderful, very obscure mountain, which recalls us the way Melville wrote Moby Dick. If you recall where Melville he wrote the novel, he wrote it in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, with in front a big mountain, which was for him Moby Dick. That mountain was Mount Greylock, and here it is constructed in a very interesting way by Melville, the Glasgow boy. The description of that beautiful picture, that is unfortunate that I cannot show it here, but the description given by the museum, by the Kelvin Grove Museum, is exactly what we were doing here. They say, Melville's dark tones and choice of an evening setting reflect a renewed interest in the work of Whistler. He eliminated the tales in favor of atmosphere and created an almost abstract picture. So this abstraction in the corazón is the one who is projected in the particulars of our reason below. So this back and forth between the we are whales and the whales are beyond us is like an introduction for this kind of knowledge, and I pass the word to Laura.
Thanks. Well, my charge is to put Fernando's interpretation of Moby Dick and the whale in conversation with the interpretation of Moby Dick and the whale offered by C.L.R. James in his book Mariners, Renegades, and Castaways, the story of Herman Melville and the world we live in. So James is not a mathematician or a physicist. He's most known for his multiple accounts of the Haitian Revolution and his writing about colonialism and slavery as the underpinnings of modern notions of freedom. He's a key figure in what Cedric J. Robinson calls the Black radical tradition, and he's working in and beyond Marx and Marx's vision of association, which he actually argues that Melville anticipates in some ways in this book. So I'm just going to talk about some of what James attunes to and turn it back to Fernando, who's written a lovely book about Melville that many of these quotes came from, called Under the Sign of Jonah. So James's book on Moby Dick comes out of extensive collaborations in the U.S. with left intellectuals and factory workers in Detroit, among other folks. It became a key element in his appeal when he was interned and expelled from the U.S. for his radical proclivities and activities. He sees Moby Dick as a book about the U.S., but also more fundamentally about modern industrial civilization, or more broadly, Western civilization. The world we live in, as the subtitle of his book. Melville is interested in men, he says, and James is interested in the new kinds of men Melville offers us. He's especially interested in Ahab, who represents for James the endpoint of industrial civilization, figured in the whale ship as floating factory, a floating factory over which Ahab presides as its authoritarian foreman. The endpoint of civilization industrial civilization is the endpoint of Western civilization as a whole, and the idea of the individual, the isolated I it produces, which is taken, he argues, to its limits in the lethal monomaniacal project Ahab pursues. On the other hand, he's interested in the alternative he sees in the quotidian modes of organization practiced by the anonymous crew who work on the ship. By the mariners, renegades, and castaways he mentions in the title, and the savages, as he puts it, that make up its ranks. Here he sees the knowledge or know-how for surviving Western civilization taking shape right within the factory or ship among the crews it has assembled. From the mariners, renegades, castaways, and he often adds savages, there is something like what he describes elsewhere as the socialism already in force on the shop floor. The savages are not at all Rousseau's noble savages, he remarks. The knowledge they have generated emerges in the context of their work together as members of this anonymous crew, and in the context of their ongoing quotidian immersion in the ocean and in the flesh, blood, and blubber of the whale itself that the work entails. So the whale manifests itself in this way. Moby Dick is, James argues, the first comprehensive statement in literature of the conditions and perspectives for the survival of Western civilization, which is here shown as doomed. And then that it begins and ends on a ship is perhaps no accident, perhaps a clue in the way we were talking about it yesterday. For although James never explicitly mentions slavery in the book, it is everywhere else in his writing understood to be central to the story of modern civilization. In Fernando's book, Under the Sign of Jonah, descent into the depths, the invisible geography, the subterranean layers, is hidden. The invisible geography that is hidden within the visible, and the dissolution of the I that descent entails, is in Melville and in the painter Albert Pinkham Ryder and the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce and the many other interesting figures he brings together under the sign of Jonah. The starting point for a reconfiguration and expansion of knowledge that becomes possible upon reascent. This is the model of knowledge that he finds everywhere in these practices that he investigates. The descent to the abyss and later ascent provide a fuller version of infinitude, an illumination derived from an encounter of opposites, a strength of overcoming that become essential preludes of knowledge. It is figured in Moby Dick, in Pip's immersion in the ocean, as Fernando marks, but also in the immersive experience Melville produces for his readers, in his richly detailed prose, in the obscurity, the negativity, or the abyss-like field he generates. So I did some very rough translations of Fernando's accounts of it this morning that I will just share. He says, the material expanse of descriptive and inquisitive lines and pages in Moby Dick, the difficult and coarse grammatical structure of Melville's prose, serves particularly well to reflect, in the fine grain of aesthetic creation, the faint outlines of the cosmos. It serves as mute witness to the way the profound currents of the world collide with a fragile eye that appears in the abyss, hoping to capture its immense complexity, an eye that is finally dragged by the whirlwind. Melville, along with Ryder and Peirce, all try to descend and ascend these infinite abysses. Often literally hanging in the abyss, they extend the cords that hold them. They refine the warp that permits them to rest in the vertical limits of the drop and mentally weave the descent to the profundities. I hope I haven't mistranslated anything. I'm interested in this idea of hanging in the abyss as this interstitial moment, perhaps, and in the figure of the cord, which in Moby Dick we might find in the corresponding figure of the rope. And that is something that James certainly gravitates to. And, of course, gravitational field is full of ropes and the reflections of ropes, which are so beautiful. And we were talking all night last night about the cords that bind. the strings from ribbed, yes, in Jane Eyre and in pop songs, the thing, the ties between us. So I attuned to James's interest in that. Can we think about James' analysis in these terms? James's analysis in terms of the terms that Fernando offers and in the terms of the hanging cord. James says little about the specific contours of Melville's prose, although he quotes it extensively and clearly relishes it. His focus, again, is on Melville's characters. For James, this is a story about men, individual men, and by way of men, the world in which they live. Melville's great achievement is, for James, his visionary anticipation of the character of Ahab and his clear rendition of the havoc this character can't but wreak. And it's also in his other great achievement is the alternative in foreseeing and producing and attuning us to the alternative he finds in the skill and pleasure of the work of the crew. While he is interested in the dramatic descents and ascents that occur throughout the book, he is much more interested in the daily immersion of the crew at work and the knowledge that is generated by way of that regular practice, which, while not put forward in philosophical terms, James insists, is equally philosophically significant. He offers us an instance of the men at work, the crew at work, in the chapter called The Monkey Rope. Here, Queequeg, one of the harpooners, who has just harpooned a whale and is responsible for securing and dismembering it, also hangs suspended in the ocean, tied to a rope. And it's a particularly precarious situation because he's between the whale and the ship and in danger of being crushed that way. And having harpooned the whale, there is blood everywhere, the water is filled with sharks that are on the attack. And it's his job to begin to dismember the whale part by part. He's kept alive, however, by Ishmael, who regularly pulls him out of harm's way, risking being pulled in himself. The notion of the monkey rope suggests, Ishmael reflects, a loss of individual will. The idea of the term comes from the from an idea of a entertainer holding a monkey by a rope and controlling him as a kind of street performance. It suggests a loss of individual will, of self-determination, insofar as the person being pulled is more like a monkey than a man. But on the Pequod, the person on the other end of the rope is also tied to it. So both of their fates are entwined. And I thought I would read a passage just to give you an idea of the passages that James is gravitating towards. He says, this is a long one, so I'm relying on the transcriber to keep you with me. It was a humorously perilous business for both of us, for before we proceeded further, it must be said that the monkey rope was fast at both ends, fast to Queequeg's broad canvas belt, and fast to my narrow leather one, so that for better or for worse, we too, for the time, were wedded. And should poor Queequeg sink to rise no more, then both usage and honor demanded that instead of cutting the cord, it should drag me down in his wake. So then, an elongated Siamese ligature united us. Queequeg is my own inseparable twin brother, nor could I in any way get rid of the dangerous liabilities which the hempen bond entailed. So strongly and metaphysically did I conceive of my situation then, that while earnestly watching his motions, I seemed distinctly to perceive that my own individuality was now merged in a joint stock company of two, that my free will had received a mortal wound, and that another's mistake or misfortune might plunge innocent me into unmerited disaster and death. Therefore, I saw that here was a sort of interregnum in providence, for its even-handed equity could never have sanctioned so gross an injustice. And yet, still further pondering, while I jerked him now and then from between the whale and the ship, which would threaten to jam him, still further pondering, I say I saw that this situation of mine was the precise situation of every mortal that breathes, only in most cases he, one way or other, has this Siamese connection with a plurality of other mortals. If your banker breaks, you snap. If your apothecary by mistake sends you poison in your pills, you die. True, you may say that, by exceeding caution, you may possibly escape these and the multitudinous other evil chances of life, but handle Queequeg's monkey rope heedfully as I would, sometimes he jerked it so that I came very near sliding overboard. Nor could I possibly forget that, do what I would, I only had the management of one end of it. Queequeg is immersed in the ocean alongside the whale and its blood and the parts that he's peeling off of it bit by bit. It's not a matter, in this case, of just submerging oneself in the ocean, nor is it a matter of entering the whale and being spat back out. The knowledge of how to live, how to survive, and how to live here is to be found in James's reading in the kind of this kind of strange and regular immersion that the work on a whale ship entails, immersion within a dense social and ecological field, in the water, and then in the try works, in the heart of the ship, where the whale's blubber is dissolved. If, as James suggests, the whiteness of Moby Dick, the whale Ahab chases, is a projection of his own inner torment that his isolation as foreman ensures, he can't properly see it, and killing it can't but be killing himself and everyone else. But the whale itself, its very substance, provides another field for immersion here. It's not the whiteness of the whale, but the viscosity that matters. And James is particularly interested in what goes on in the try works, which is really where only the anonymous crew enters and works. Here, within the violence of industrial civilization, but against the monomaniacal individualism that is its presumed accomplishment, and as James continually reminds us, its assured end, James focuses in on the very different experience the descent into the tri-work allows. And I will read another passage, and then I'm almost done. So it's a different kind of descent or immersion, perhaps. And Ishmael says, It was our business to squeeze these lumps back into fluid, a sweet and unctuous duty. I'm skipping some parts here. After having my hands in it for only a few minutes, my fingers felt like eels and began, as it were, to serpentine and spiralize. I bathed my hands among those soft, gentle globules of infiltrated tissues, woven almost within the hour, as they richly broke to my fingers and discharged all their opulence, like fully ripe grapes, their wine, and I snuffed up that uncontaminated aroma. Squeeze, 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 all the morning long, I squeezed that sperm till I myself almost melted into it. I squeezed that sperm till a strange sort of insanity came over me, and I found myself unwittingly squeezing my co-laborers' hands in it, mistaking their hands for the gentle globules. Such an abounding, affectionate, friendly, loving feeling did this avocation beget that at last I was continually squeezing their hands and looking up into their eyes sentimentally, as much as to say, oh, my dear fellow beings, why should we longer cherish any social acerbities or know the slightest ill humor or envy? Come, let us squeeze hands all around. Nay, let us all squeeze ourselves into each other. And the erotics of those passages do not escape James's attention either. It's a, for him, it's a moment of fellowship and erotic connection that is the basis for a whole other idea of how one might live. Here, where men breathe and taste and touch the whale as it is dismembered and dissolved, where their hands become both serpentine and spiralized, mistaken for globules of blubber themselves, where they might squeeze themselves into each other, perhaps we have less clearly a matter of descent and reascent. Here they are swallowed or dissolved by the whale as they dissolve it and swallow it, commenting at length even on its flavor in a later passage, and imagine dissolving into one another. One of the phrases Fernando uses to describe the conditions for expanded knowledge that interests him, the dissolution of the eye through immersion in the infinite, the obscurity, the darkness, the subterranean layers, is that what in Spanish is compenetración. He stages it in terms of eye world, but compenetración means rapport or understanding. But in Spanish, I think it retains the idea of a kind of mutual penetration, which I think speaks in some ways to what James is interested in here. Mm. Not perhaps as a descent and ascent, but as a kind of lateral experience. Is it a loss of point of view, a proliferation of point of views, a confusion? Is there a geometrical construction that could account for this? I would put those questions to you, Fernando. It emerges again within the very violence of Ahab's project, both the project of industrial production and on this voyage, the monomaniacal pursuit of Moby Dick, the narrowest, most linear of pursuits. If I heard you correctly, Fernando, earlier you said that whales are a fundamental metaphor for the complex stratification of the world. Yeah, but then what is the human being? James argues that Melville would go on to write more expressly that a human being is nothing more than a distilled concentration of all the elemental forces of nature, earth, air, fire, lightning, etc. That's as close as James comes, at least, to anything like physics. So I'm going to rely on you to translate it back into math. But this experience in the monkey rope and the experience in the tri-works are the kind of knowledge that James suggests Melville finds in the experience and the know-how and the pleasures of the crew. And those are the ones that he tries to transmit. It does not come, this knowledge, James insists, from Melville. It is not a product of any individual eye. It comes from Melville's observation and a kind of prescience that comes to him as, and here he quotes Melville, the strange stuff, or maybe this is James himself, the strange stuff which upheaves and upgushes in the writer's soul. Melville is the medium, the instrument for its transmission, for this account of modern civilization's end, which awaits an audience, James says, which might be ready to listen. James is, in this sense, an instrument too. And as Fernando notes in his book, Melville as instrument is itself fully immersed in the universe, in the midst of himself of a slow process of dissolution. And Fernando digs up an old letter that Melville writes to Hawthorne, in which Melville says, "If you find grains of sand in this letter, don't mind those. Those are just pieces of me that have sloughed off as I write the book Moby Dick." So I put those observations, those of James, back to you, Fernando, to see how you might think them through the lens of math and physics and the models that you proposed.
So thank you for your reading. It was really incredible, and going to my Spanish and translating and getting the best ideas. Thank you very much. It was really, I couldn't have done it better. So thank you very much, Laura, for that. I will respond only quickly to three of the many threads that you opened, and we can continue the conversation. Also, Barry, when you want, and yourselves. So the first one is related to the concentration and condensation, which is, I think, fundamental in Melville. And today, Nathaniel was in one moment pointing to the importance of condensation in poetry, and the concentration of the English language in Melville is completely incredible in Moby Dick. This kind of extreme materiality of the language is for me really something which moves me profoundly. The idea of getting in the extreme detail and the extreme condensation of the material to get from there an openness, a strange openness to something which is beyond us and which provides an abstraction in the materiality is something I think unique in Melville. He goes in a very detailed way through long descriptions of the very job of whaling, and it's incredible how when we follow this very detailed and precise, condensed, concentrated reading, then we, in one moment, we see how everything opens up in one certain moment, and abstraction is there, beyond the materiality of the language. That's something very impressive, and I will try to elaborate that tomorrow in the conversation that we will have with Fred and Nathaniel, try to explain from a mathematical point of view how it can be, in a very strong sense, shown that if you go in extreme detail to the particular, and you do a very simple mathematical inversion, then you get the whole world of the abstraction. I will try to show that tomorrow in a precise way. But for the moment, just to say that I see that in Melville, and as Laura explained very well, in the perfection of the materiality and in the perfection of the descriptions that she read about Melville, you can see this kind of abstract geometry emerging in a strong way. So about this geometry, Laura was explaining that there are at least two important levels, the level of the rope that she was explaining to us, and that we have seen in the gravitational performance, and the organization of the ropes there, and how we are involved in all the materiality that, in fact, if we play with that materiality, in some sense, we liberate ourselves. That's something which is very impressive for me, how going to the very material, in some moment, the materiality helps us to breathe, finally. We are breathing, opening a new way of understanding things. So there is a geometry behind that, which is, on one side, the horizontal geometry of the rope, which corresponds for those who were with me in the study session, to the fibers of the sheaf. In a sheaf, you have this projection of a bigger space onto a smaller space. When you take the inverse of the projection, you get the fibers in a horizontal perspective. So the fibers are the rows, the cords, and also in a horizontal way, the one that Laura was explaining, you have the crew in which you have this kind of interrelationships which go beyond the vertical one, but you have some sections, some horizontal sections which correspond to the sections of a sheaf. In a sheaf, you have at least two types of perspectives: the horizontal perspective corresponding to fibers, and the vertical perspective corresponding to fibers, and the horizontal perspective corresponding to the sections. So there is a natural geometry in there that it's explained in all detail of the back and forth between the material and the abstract. So those were the basic comments. I don't know, Barry, you want to enter?
Well, the first thing I feel I should say is that I've scheduled this really badly, so we've not got lots of time left, which is entirely my fault. Maybe I would see if anybody has any questions in the audience. I have some questions, but because we haven't got a lot of time, it might be nice to see if anybody in the audience has a question. If not, then I guess the thing, like in summarizing what you were both talking about or drawing it together, it seems to me that like in the way that you were talking and in some of the study session upstairs, you're talking about this like this dissolution of the point or dissolution of the individual or the local or something, and that's that dissolution of the local, the dissolution of like narrow views or something, dissolution of the individual is the way in which we're going to move towards some kind of enlarged reason.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, and the enlarged reason is what we need, these multiple perspectives that we can glue together that allow us to escape the violence that's kind of embedded in narrow views or in individual views or something. And it seems like in what James is saying or something, that like Ahab, the traditional like reading of Moby Dick, that why Americans claimed it to be a great book, was that like Ahab is seen as this totalitarian, the ultimate individual or something, and that American kind of like literal criticism sees Ishmael as some kind of like American response to totalitarianism or something, but James says no, he's just like an intellectual totalitarian. He's, you know, he's just as bad as the other. But so James sets up in his reading of it something really similar to what you're saying. He sets up this kind of like in the destruction of Ahab, in his assured end, like the destruction of him as a self. We can find that, and we can see that in the kind of like what he calls like the renegades. Castaways, in the kind of, who he reads as a kind of like a world federation of industrial workers or something. There's like, is there some kind of model for the way in which, regardless of how individuation is impressed upon us, there's something through this like the people who have no affiliation to nation. He calls them nobodies, you know. But at the same time, they're kind of through their work and through their like affective entanglement, they produce some kind of other form of sociality that can never be stamped out by the input. I'm actually just rambling a little bit. That's how I was trying to synthesize what you were saying.
No, I think that, you know, James gives a political dimension to the question of the single point, mm-hmm. right? And tries to find ways in which the crew, in their self-organization, in their expertise, you know, the anonymous crew, the lowly crew, renegades, and castaways, their expertise, but also the pleasures that they uh-huh. take in working and working together, and their sense of connection to one another, is the part where he sees something like a displacement of the singular point of view. I mean, I just picked two of the passages that he stressed that describe the particular interest he has in the displacement of that.
I would think that for our times, and I experience it a lot with my students at the university, I think that for the young people, it's very, very important to have a kind of thought or general system of organization of our thoughts about the problem of the dissolution of the I. I think that the I is too extremely connected now to people. People are always talking about themselves in the web, and they are exposing themselves in the web, and there is this gigantic I, which I think it's very strange, something very strange to me, but which all the time works around the young people today. I see them extremely concentrated in themselves. So I fight systematically with them in my teaching courses, in which I try to explain that mathematics is well beyond myself, well beyond. And poetry is well beyond myself, and we have to fight against the I. And the dissolution of the I in Melville is something so strong, so forceful. That's why I think that Moby Dick is now so important for our times. It's not just a magnificent piece of literary imagination, a magnificent piece of philosophical freedom, a magnificent piece of abstraction and materiality at the same time, a political piece. It has this wide dimensionality, but I think it's particularly important for that, at least for me, because it's a strong statement that the I should be dissoluted, that we have to fight against individualism, against the singular, the personal, and we have to use the tools that culture or philosophy or thought have provided us in order to fight against that I. That's why it's Melville is so important for me. And I was saying I will try to explain this in a mathematical way tomorrow night, in which there is a very good way of systematically dissolving the I. If we follow a very simple mathematical theorem, Cauchy's residues theorem, and we produce a metaphor about that, you will see how with very simple mathematical tools which come from the 19th century, with Melville, things which seem very far away, they are very present today. I think, at least for me, they are very present when I see this kind of extreme attention to the self, which I don't like at all.
Thanks. I had a question actually for both of you. Maybe it's foreshadowing tomorrow already, because you say that under the material conditions, under the materiality, you find abstraction, right? And Stefano Harni, in an interview, what first happened in Italian and then got translated and reproduced in social text, he calls this what also happens in under comments, right? There is, he talks about the materiality under the materiality. Which is the hapticality, which is love, right? It's the possibility of relationality that happens actually under that materiality. Are you having radically different conclusions, or is this hapticality, this love and abstraction, is that actually related through your scheme, for instance?
I would agree completely with that idea. The study of the materiality, of the unmateriality, is something which should be very, very important for us today. In the same perspective, that our world is so material, we have all the woods around us, and all the young people are all the time playing with things which are very easy for them, etc., which is very, very material. In some moment, if you immerse in that completely, I think that the very conscience of the young people should in one moment invert themselves and then get to this unmateriality, which is the really important thing beyond. this spirit, which in spirit in a wide sense, which should prevail around us and which should produce a community. The community, I think, is strange, but I really believe that the community is produced by forces which are non-material in some ways.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if I should ask my question again, but actually the way that you speak about spirit and unmateriality takes me back to this question of the Song of the Whale. And I was wondering if you could maybe speak about perhaps a mathematical understanding of sound and sounding and spatiality in that way. But because also the element of sound makes me think of hearing, and that for me, I'm interested in hearing you speak about hearing not so much in relation to the individual self, but the reality of embodied sensory perception.
About the question, there is one, a part of the English that I didn't get. It's a question about how sound of hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
About that, the introduction of Grothendieck is also important for us. I spoke in my study session before about Alexander Grothendieck. For those who were not there, he's a very great mathematician, one of the greatest mathematicians of all times, and certainly the greatest mathematician of the last 50 or 60 years, in which he invented something very important, which is the generalization of the space-time of Einstein. The space-time is an understanding of geometry related to the development of time. But Grothendieck went well beyond that, and he did an intersection between space and number. Time is just the linear perspective of the number. The ramifications of number give you a space number, which is much more important for the development of general mathematical imagination. So Grothendieck was at the same time a musician and a mathematician. In one moment he was not sure if he was going to be a musician or a mathematician. Fortunately, he went on mathematics because his mathematics are really incredible, and probably he would have been a very low musician. But in any case, Grothendieck all the time talked about how structures sounded for him. He was hearing structures. He had some sense of hidden things in our mathematical imagination or in the world, that if we tune up well our hearing, then we could get some harmonies that were usually hidden. That is also what happens with the languages of the whales. The whales emit some sounds which are not usual for us. We cannot understand their language. They are beyond us. But in some moments, with some advancements of literature or science, we approach that thing which is beyond us. So there are sounds, the whale sounds, which are in principle beyond us, but if we tune enough our hearing, for example, like Grothendieck did with mathematical structures, he heard some harmonics that no one other person heard was able to hear in that moment. So the question of hearing what is not usually heard is something which is very important, and is also related to the idea of seeing something which cannot be seen, or to write something which cannot be written, or to do a gesture which cannot be produced. This is something that we are going to do with Tosh in our session in Saturday. I will do some mathematical things that in principle I cannot do, but certainly with her body, she will be able to produce a visual of mathematics, which is very important for us. So those kind of things are the ones that are there in those dialectics.
Okay.
Grothendieck called it like maths as being the listening to the voice of things.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Grothendieck said that. You have to listen the voice of things. Those things were just imaginary things or also natural things. Mm-hmm. Both of them, he was open to both of them, to both those possibilities. And he insisted a lot of times that he was hearing it, and he produced incredible mathematics from that, so we can believe him, I think. Yeah.
Well, I think we're out of time, so I just wanted to thank everybody. Thank you both for your comments. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We're going to have a little quick turnaround, and then the Brazilian schizoscenic theatre company that we worked with before, Wayne's, have made a version of Moby Dick, which they've filmed for us, a kind of video play that we're going to show in, 20 minutes or something. So please stick around and check that out. They're really incredible and close to our hearts. So, thank you very much. Thank you.